Well, thank you very much. I'm really grateful for the Institute for Policy Reform, Humayun, Ashraf, for inviting me. And so I'm very grateful that you should also be here on a hot afternoon when you could be rested. Well, I think we've learned a lot from the last two speakers. I really appreciated Humayun's discourse on the human development aspects of national security, which are really enormously neglected in Pakistan. His choice of word that security decision making in Pakistan is inadequate is put very moderately compared to what the real crisis is. And General Saab has really moved us on the need for peace with India and the end of using non-state actors as a policy. Now, I have a lot to say, and I'm not going to give you an analysis. So what I've done is I've made bullet points, some of which I'll read and some of which I'll speak, and I hope that you will be able to, follow. So I've got 9 bullet points on foreign policy, and then a few points on our future direction. Pakistan's, number one, Pakistan says India is trying to isolate us and creating a two-front crisis for Pakistan. The truth is that we are creating a three-front situation for ourselves, making enemies of Afghanistan, Iran, and India. Nobody is doing to us what we are not doing to ourselves. Number two, if our policies were neighborhood friendly, India could not intervene to this extent, either by sabotaging CPAC or sabotaging our relations with Iran or Afghanistan. No other country is at odds with so many of its neighbors as Pakistan is at present. Number three, in the meantime, the internal terrorism problem we face has got worse recently. Although there have been dramatic improvements in Fatah, the terrorists have moved elsewhere, particularly to Balochistan, which has now become the epicenter for not only Pakistani extremists, but Afghans, Central Asians, Chinese Muslims, and various others. Unfortunately, we are externalizing all our internal problems. In other words, we are blaming everyone else for our problems except ourselves. And this makes it impossible for us to look into ourselves and see where we are going wrong. We lay the blame on India or Afghanistan, but we decline to accept the crisis that we face internally. The army, the politicians, our civil society are not coming together, as General Saab said earlier. These three defining sectors of state security can't unite if we seek only external enemies for the cause of our problems. Number four, we blame Kabul for hosting the Pakistani Taliban, the TTP. But we have been hosting the Afghan Taliban since the early 90s. In other words, more than 25 years, a quarter of a century. We continue to allow the Afghan Taliban open access to Quetta and Peshawar, from where they can run their logistics into Afghanistan. We may not support the Afghan Taliban, but we still allow them freedom of access in all the border regions. Pakistan still constitutes a major sanctuary and rare area for the Afghan Taliban. The Quetta Shura of the Afghan Taliban sits in Quetta. It doesn't sit in Kandahar or Helmand or Mazar-e-Sharif. The last two leaders of the Taliban were elected by massive gatherings outside Quetta, and we pretend still that we are not hosting them or that they are not on our soil. We can't make policies under this game of pretense. Now the situation is much worse, as both Iran and Russia are playing the Taliban card. They don't want to repeat the 1990s, when only Pakistan had access to the Taliban government in Kabul. They are now in direct confrontation with Pakistan for influence with the Taliban. And at the same time, we are seeing fragmentation within the Taliban, And we are also seeing that many Afghan Taliban are fed up with Pakistan and are moving out to Iran or Qatar and other places. And this is all making the situation much more complicated. Meanwhile, let's have a look at the TTP. They are living in largely inaccessible areas along the border with Pakistan, in the provinces of Kunar, Nuristan, Badakhshan, where even US forces, when they had over 100,000 troops in Afghanistan, failed to establish bases. This is a very, very rugged area. And with a very low population, it produces very little. The TTP are under the protection of the Afghan Taliban, who lord it over in that region. The Afghan Taliban also protect Al-Qaeda, the Islamic Movement of Uzbekistan, Chinese Uyghurs, and others in the same border regions. So the TTP is not alone. They have many allies and friends working with them. They may also have links to Afghan intelligence, but their major protection in the area that they're living in comes from the Afghan Taliban. So even as we extend hospitality and favors to the Afghan Taliban on our soil, they in turn are protecting our enemies, the TTP, inside Afghanistan. Next time we present a list of wanted TTP terrorists to President Ashraf Ghani, we should also send the list to the Afghan Taliban in Quetta. If Afghan Taliban are so friendly with Pakistan, why are they not arresting TTP leaders in Kunar and Nuristan and Badakhshan and handing them over to us? I think in all these years, the Afghan Taliban have not handed over anybody to Pakistan for creating problems in Pakistan. Number five, our recent relations with the Afghan state, many see it as nothing short of bully. For Afghanistan is a fragile, failing state. It is not a normal state, yet we tend to treat it as though it has a regular army, regular government, regular bureaucracy. The Taliban today control maybe two-thirds of Afghanistan. This is not a normal state we're dealing with. Why are we browbeating the Afghans, which is incapable of looking after its own borders, while we pretend it's a normal country? After 37 years of covering Afghanistan, I still have no idea as to what our policy is trying to achieve today. We allow the Afghan Taliban on our soil. We do not castigate them or hold them up for bringing in the TTPs who are sitting in Afghanistan. This situation is becoming intolerable because it is increasing terrorism and extremism in Pakistan. Afghanistan is a failing state. Do we understand the consequences of Afghanistan as a failing state? Are we treating it as a failing state? Do we want a failed state on our borders again? Didn't we have enough and suffer enough during the Soviet occupation and after they left in 1989 when Afghanistan exported extremism, drugs, guns, etc. into Pakistan? Have we all forgotten that period? At that point in time, Afghanistan was a failed state. And plunging very quickly into civil war, which lasted until 9/11. We desperately need a peaceful solution to Pakistan more than any other state. Six, what do the Afghans think of us? I don't even want to use the language that many Afghans use about Pakistan, which is very sad given the help that we have given the Afghans over decades. But many Afghans now loathe Pakistan. They consider Pakistan as a worse enemy than Russia was in the 80s or the Americans were after 9/11. So they blame us for everything. And they use us now to explain their own failures. So if they are corrupt, incompetent, dishonest, steeped in warlordism, all of that blame is then put on us, which makes our situation even more difficult. Yet, if Afghanistan continues with another year's offensive of the Taliban, it is heading to be a failed state. And we should be doing everything possible that we can to prevent that thing from happening. Ashraf Ghani in his approach did try very hard to win over the Pakistan military when he came and met with General Rahil. We failed to take up that opportunity. When, if you remember, Ghani had held off taking arms from India, he had held off forming close ties with India for more than 6 months to give Pakistan a chance to respond and create a dialogue between the Afghan Taliban and Kabul. We give India the room with which to operate in Afghanistan only because we refuse to befriend the Afghans. The next Afghan leader, which could possibly be Hamid Karzai, will be even more anti-Pakistan than the present leadership. And we should be aware of that. 7. I don't underestimate what India is doing, but India does not create the opportunities to arm or fund terrorists. We create that opportunity with our own lack of policy, and India then takes advantage of it. India is certainly helping Afghan state and Afghan intelligence, funding Baloch separatists, trying to undermine CPAC. But it's our job to make peace on our borders, which is the best way to prevent Indian interference. By the recent closing of the borders in Chaman and Torkham, we were the ones who lost out, the traders and the people more on this side of the border who were trying to sell goods to Afghanistan. India is both a short-term and a long-term threat, but we cannot endanger our relations with other neighbors just for the satisfaction of poking India in the eye. No doubt this is a terrible government in India for both the Indians and for Pakistan. We have never seen this kind of expression of Hindu fundamentalism, suppression or brutal suppression of the Kashmiri uprising and its intentions to weaken Pakistan. But let's not create opportunities for them to do this by quickly mending our ties with Iran and Afghanistan. The truth is, as was demonstrated very clearly yesterday at The Hague, we are globally isolated on India. Because India is considered a global economic power, now second only to China. It attracts massive foreign investment. It has a growth rate of 6 to 7%, outstripping us. Nobody tends to listen to us in the global community on what we have to say about Kashmir, or defense of Indian Muslims, or even on issues like water and trade. As long as we harbor extremist groups that target both Afghanistan or India, we are not treated as a normal or an honest state by the world community. And if we are to be rational, there's little doubt that Modi will probably win the next elections in India. We are facing an Indian extremist government, possibly for the next 7 to 8 years. Now, can we maintain this level of belligerency against India for so long when our primary aim is to make CPAC succeed? We need to reach out and normalize relations with India. Likewise with Iran. On the border with Iran, Sunni groups in Balochistan have been attacking Iran since Musharraf's time. Our involvement with the Saudi-led force in the Gulf, which is now led by a Pakistani general, is considered by Tehran as anti-Iran and anti-Shia. Iran has also recruited large numbers of Pakistanis to fight in Syria, and these could return to Pakistan and create mayhem. Iran is a neighbor and needs to be treated with respect, just as Pakistani Shias need to be treated with equal respect. Now, I have now just 5 or 6 very brief points as to what I think, you know, we should be doing in the weeks and months ahead. Our borders are basically insecure, because we continue to allow two sets of extremists, one on the Punjab border, Lashkar-e-Taiba, Jaish and other groups, and the other, the Afghan Taliban on the western border. 2, we need to take the lead in restarting talks between Kabul and the Taliban. We can't wait for the US or the Americans to do it. As peacemakers in Afghanistan, we could start to rectify our image with the Afghans and in the world, and also put pressure on countries to support our point of view on India. 3, there has to be minimal cooperation on foreign policy between the government and the army. It is not a secret that the Prime Minister would love to normalize relations with India and Afghanistan, but the army is opposed as it is seen to be giving away too much too soon. This needs a resolution through compromise, not confrontation, and not seeing all of Pakistan's security issues through Indian eyes. By that I mean, I see Afghanistan, or a failed state in Afghanistan, as being possibly a bigger security threat to Pakistan even than the threat from India. A few words on CPAC. CPAC needs security, above all ending the war in Afghanistan and peace in Balochistan, which is today the epicenter of terrorism. If India is arming Baloch separatists, why have we not made peace in Balochistan after 10 years of conflict and declared a general amnesty like Zia-ul Haq did and stopped the insurgency? CPAC needs friendly neighbors, which we have failed to achieve. CPAC security cannot be measured in how many divisions of soldiers we raise or how many divisions we deploy along the route from Gwadar to the Chinese border. Recent incidents in Gwadar and Mustum show you can raise any number of troops, but you can't guarantee that there will be no terrorism. The lack of transparency on CPAC is also creating a storm of protest in the country. How can we persuade smaller provinces to accept CPAC if there is no debate on routes or financing, how much it is costing, what effect it will have on the national debt, and what will China gain at Pakistan's cost? How will Pakistan return the huge debt that is building up? All of this should be made public. Finally, the government has refused to utilize institutions like the Defense Committee of the Cabinet and the National Security Council, where it could sit face to face with the army instead of trying to personalize the relationship with army chiefs, instead of trying to institutionalize it. The army wants institutions, and it wants debate and discussion through institutions rather than through personal choices. Both the government and the army are responsible for diminishing the Foreign Office and the role of the Foreign Office. The government by not making a permanent foreign minister with full authority and power, and the army by conducting foreign policy independently. The lack of consultation between the military, parliament, politicians, civil society and the media is growing worse, not better. And to think that we will be soon going into another election with this kind of situation, I find is very critical. Thank you very much.